The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, what can we learn from the recent return to the Greek waters of Antikythera, the shipwreck site where the famous Antikythera mechanism was recovered from? What do we now know about this 2,000-year-old proto-computer and what other ancient Greek technologies might remain to be discovered? And does an expedition funded by tech billionaires throw up ethical dilemmas for the archaeologists doing the work? Plus, in science news, the UK votes to allow the creation of babies with DNA from three people, and NASA's twin astronaut study prepares for launch. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The Antikythera wreck lies off the Greek island of Antikythera to the northwest of Crete. It was discovered in 1900 and subsequently explored by Jacques Cousteau in 1976. The boat is thought to be Roman, dating back to the 1st century BC. The marine archaeologist Brendan Foley has been exploring the site with Greek archaeologists since 2012, using new diving technology which allows a fuller, complete survey of the Antikythera wreck site. He's assembled a team of the world's top technical divers, along with new equipment such as state-of-the-art robotic submarines and the Exosuit, the world's most advanced diving suit. I'm delighted to say that Brendan Foley joins me now, along with Dr. Serafina Cuomo, who works at Birkbeck University of London, on the history of mathematics and technology in ancient Greek and Roman times, and by the journalist Joe Marchant, author of Decoding the Heavens, Solving the Mystery of the World's First Computer. Brendan, let me start with you. Why did you go back to the wreck site last year?
The easiest response to that is the Greek government invited us to. The site, of course, has been known since 1900. And since that time, since Cousteau went back in 53 and then in 76, it has just sat uninvestigated. So over the last 10 years or more, I've been working with the effort of underwater antiquities in Greece to survey shipwreck sites all over Greek territorial seas. And slowly, slowly, we've been building toward the return to Antikythera. It's been 5 or 6 years in the planning, and last year was the first really big push to investigate the site.
What specifically about that site is of interest to you, though?
Well, it's a funny thing, because the site is actually too young for my academic interest. I'm far more interested in shipwrecks that date to the invention of civilization back in the Bronze Age. But this shipwreck is unlike anything else that's ever been discovered. It was traveling with all of the highest quality luxury goods that were available in the 1st century BC. And, of course, the thing that sets it apart is the Antikythera mechanism. Nothing like that has ever been found in archaeology. I think it may be the most spectacular, most amazing single artifact ever recovered from an archaeological site.
Joe, you've written the book on the Antikythera mechanism, Decoding the Heavens. Give our listeners an idea of what this mechanism was for people who've never heard of it. If there are people out there who've never heard of this, what is it? What was it for?
Some people call it an ancient computer. Some people call it an ancient calculator. It was a bronze clockwork mechanism, pretty much, except that unlike a clock, which sort of ticks on its own after you wind it up, this one you would wind by hand, enclosed in a wooden box about the size of a clock you'd have on your mantelpiece, with dials and pointers on the front and back. And what it was basically doing is modelling the movements of celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, the planets. So you turn a handle on the side and pointers go around showing you the positions of the sun and the moon and the planets in the sky. Not just that, it also had a calendar on it. There was information about what stars were rising and setting and an eclipse prediction dial. So it was absolutely breathtaking when it was discovered. And it's taken pretty much 100 years for scholars to really get to the bottom of what this thing was and how it works. But there's nothing like it from a technological point of view for pretty much 1,000 years afterwards.
So take us through how they found it. When does it date back to?
So this wreck site, as Brendan said, was first found in 1900 by sponge divers, completely by accident. There's a story that the first sponge diver who saw it saw a pile of bodies of men, women and horses on the seabed and panicked. It came up, but then it subsequently turned out that these were actually statues, bronze and marble statues. And so then they worked with the Greek government to bring stuff up. And it's deep. It's like 55 metres deep. And they were diving in these sort of canvas suits, breathing pressurised air through a hose from the boat above. So very dangerous work. One of them died during it. And they brought up all of these treasures, including this one kind of corroded lump that didn't look like anything. And it was only months later that it cracked open and they saw these traces of bronze gear wheels, inscriptions, and realised that they had something really special here.
And presumably this mechanism, once they've pieced it together, how it works with all the cogs and whatnot, it must have had things like epicycles, because they would have thought the Earth was the centre of the solar system and so on.
Yeah, that's right. So it wasn't just showing you the speed of the sun and the moon and the planets around the zodiac that this would have been. So it wasn't just showing them at constant speed. They were really complicated trains of gear wheels, wheels riding on other wheels, showing you the apparent speed. So when we look at the sun and the moon and the planets from Earth, you know, because we're orbiting the sun, not the other way around, they look as if they're speeding up and slowing down. They don't just go at constant speed. And so the Greeks had all sorts of mathematical algorithms to explain that. And they're actually encoding all of those within this mechanism. You've got gear wheels riding around on other gear wheels to show how those bodies are speeding up and slowing down. So it's really incredibly sophisticated.
Seraphine, let's bring you in. This sounds like an extraordinary piece of technology for the time, but do things like this appear in ancient texts? Are things like this written about, and were they sort of commonplace technologies?
As far as I know, there isn't any textual description of anything like the antique ITERA mechanism. But what we do have is, on the one hand, description of gear mechanisms, of cogwheels, in a completely different context. So we have description in treatises that talk about mechanics of cogwheel mechanisms that can help you to, for instance, lift weights. So that technology is described in some texts. And then we have much earlier texts, in fact, that talk about astronomical spheres. I would say one of the most famous texts that describes a sphere that imitates the motions of the heavens is often connected to the antique ITERA mechanism, because it dates from the first century BC. And it's a description that Cicero, the famous Roman orator and philosopher, has in one of his writings. He says that after Syracuse, the city in Sicily, was besieged and conquered by the Romans, and Archimedes, the famous Greek scientist who lived in Syracuse, was killed, they took to Rome as loot an astronomical celestial sphere that had been built by Archimedes. And the family of the general that conquered Syracuse, Marcellus, displayed it so that people could go and admire the handiwork, possibly of Archimedes himself. The way Cicero describes this, it looks more like an armillary sphere, which was nothing like the antique ITERA mechanism, but it is one of the many descriptions in this text and later texts of a strong interest in creating models of the heavens as objects that were not just for actually timekeeping and calculating positions, but also things to look at, luxury objects, aesthetically pleasing objects.
So showpieces, things to own as a sort of sign of prestige almost.
Yeah, and also pieces that sometimes said the history, because you could tell your family, your descendants, it would become like oral history through the family, how you had come across that object, how you had acquired that object. And there's also a very strong theme of Rome taking these things from Greece.
I want to come back to you later to ask about why these technologies weren't really built on and what other technologies there might have been written about in those texts. But Brendan, I wonder if we might come to you and just find out a bit more about the expedition in October. What did you get to do when you were out there? How did the expedition go?
The expedition went pretty well in the end. The most important thing for us was being able to generate a very, very precise map of the shipwreck, or at least a portion of it, as we understood it. And we did that by bringing a team from Australia, from the Australian Centre for Field Robotics at University of Sydney, with one of their autonomous underwater vehicles. The robot went down and mapped in hyper precision a 70 by 30 meter box, over what we thought was going to be the main cargo hold of the wreck. The resulting map, each pixel in the computer-generated map, is 4 millimeters in real space, so very, very precise. That's important because archaeology focuses on artifacts, but it's the spatial relationships among those artifacts that convey a lot of the information that we need to interpret the site. That was priority number one, and we achieved that in the first week, and it was a good thing we did, because after that, the weather turned, and it was hurricane-force winds and 4-meter seas over the wreck site, and we just couldn't get out on the site for any of our diving work. That was hyper-frustrating. So we sat on shore, our big team, 20, 25 people, just waiting for the winds to come down, and it was driving me crazy, frankly. It was tough to sit there after waiting so long to get out on the site. We had all of our technical diving gear at the ready. We had vessels. We had all kinds of support, including a SEAL team from the Greek Navy. So their combat swimmers were our safety divers. And we all just sat around waiting for the weather to break. As crazy as it was making me, I also knew that with a team as good as we had, all we needed was one good day. And finally, when the weather broke, Phil Short, who's an Englishman, one of our chief divers at Alexandro Sotiriou from Athens, got out on the site, dived down to 55 meters, and very, very quickly, with metal detectors in hand and with the knowledge of the site from the map we had generated, were able to start identifying and recovering really interesting artifacts from the wreck.
That map that you create, is that just looking at the kind of surface topography, or is it trying to get information on what may be below the surface? Is it using sort of metal detection or something like that?
The first map we made is just stereo camera. So it's producing a very accurate three-dimensional representation of the seafloor and the wreck site itself. Now, based on that and based on the success with the metal detectors we had this year, for the coming season, we're going to mount metal detectors on another kind of robot and run the survey again. And we hope to get a very accurate metal detection map, which will then, of course, focus our excavation efforts by the divers on the sites that the grid squares that seem to be the most promising.
What sort of tech do you have to get down to 55 meters or to actually explore this site for any length of time? Do you need particular equipment?
You could say that in 1901, the sponge divers were fine with just their surface-supplied bronze helmets, but as Joe pointed out, one of them died, and two more of them were permanently paralyzed. So obviously, safety is paramount for us. We couldn't go with just standard scuba diving equipment. So we've been training for years for this on closed-circuit rebreathers and mixed-gas breathing gases, which give us much, much longer bottom times and a much, much greater safety margin. Now, in addition to the sort of human-in-the-water aspects of the technology, we also this year had a big, shiny, red and silver toy called the Exosuit. It's an atmospheric diving suit. It's basically a wearable submarine. It looks like something out of Marvel Comics, Iron Man for archaeology, some people have been calling it. And basically, it's a suit that you put on made of aluminum with all sorts of joints. And in this suit, you can go down to any depth, to 1,000 feet, over 300 meters, and stay all day without a decompression penalty.
Does that suit allow you to actually do archaeology on the seabed, though? I mean, do you not need basically hands to do that kind of work? I mean, how good is it?
Well, it's a good question. It was absolutely an experiment this year. The suit was made available to us at a very reasonable day rate by J.F. White Contracting. It's a commercial construction outfit in Massachusetts. So it was absolutely just a trial run. We think that the suit could be very, very useful indeed, if for no other reason than to put a trained archaeologist who's not necessarily a diver right on site, half a meter away from the grid squares where the technical divers will be excavating. So with through-water communications between the exosuit and those divers and the boat topside, we'll have conversations down there, and the archaeologist can direct the actual excavation being down there for successive dives.
You managed to get divers down onto the site last year, if only for a short time. Was there anything interesting that they managed to pull up? Did you learn anything about the wreck site that you didn't know before?
Yeah, we learned a lot. In fact, the map that we generated, we thought was going to be over the center line amidships. And we thought that because there was a lead anchor at one extremity of this box that we surveyed. And at the other extremity, the Cousteau team in 76 had recovered all sorts of stuff from the galley, from the cooking area on the ship, the kitchen, and also personal effects, which we thought were from the passenger cabins. So we figured if the anchor denotes the bow and the galley denotes the stern, then we had the middle part of the ship. That's not what we found, though. As we started diving on the site and recovering some artifacts, finding artifacts, in that space between the anchor and the galley section, we found more things related to the galley and to the passenger compartments. For instance, a very ornate piece of a bed, which matched some of the artifacts recovered in 76 and in 1900. On the very, very southern extremity of our box, that's when things started to get exciting. The metal detector started ringing constantly. And Alexandro Sotiriou found a large bronze rigging ring, part of the ship's elements itself. And then, not too far away from it, a lagunos, a table jug that probably was carrying wine or some other beverage for use on board the ship. And then next to that, he found the most exciting artifact to come up from this season. It was a 2-meter-long bronze spear, which is certainly a statue element. That is very exciting because we know that in the National Archaeological Museum, from the earlier expeditions to the wreck site, there are pieces of 6 or 8 other life-size bronze statues from the Hellenistic period or the Classical period. So if this bronze spear comes up, it is an indication that in other areas of the seafloor down there on the wreck site, these other large bronze statues may be lying in wait for us.
Joe, I just want to bring you back in to talk about some of the new research that's been going on the Antikythera mechanism. It seems as if people don't fully understand what it was all about.
I think the big picture of what this thing was is understood, and that is thanks to a lot of X-ray work that happened in the 1990s, a guy called Michael Wright from London, and then 3D sort of high-resolution CT scanning that happened in 2005, and there was a big Nature paper in 2006 where they published a big reconstruction of the mechanism. But there still left a lot of questions. There were a lot of inscriptions written all over the front and back of this thing that hadn't been deciphered. And large parts of it are missing. So all the pointers on the front dial are missing and all the gear work that led to the planets were missing. So there were questions about, did it really show the planets? How did it show the planets? And people were obviously keen to know what these inscriptions were saying. So since those CT scans came out, a lot of different teams have been looking at that, trying to decipher them. And one of the interesting things that's come out of that is some key numbers in the inscriptions, which relate to particular astronomical cycles, which suggest very strongly that there were these gear wheels that I mentioned riding around on other gear wheels, these compound trains of gear wheels that then riding on a bigger wheel that were modelling the sort of Greek theories of the epicycles of the planet. So that was very controversial. It had been suggested, but others were like, no, there's no way the Greeks could have done that. And these inscriptions are suggesting actually, yes, they did. Something else that's interesting from the inscriptions is one of the dials on the mechanism is actually nothing to do with astronomy. It's a 4-year dial, and it's telling you the timing of different games festivals. So the Olympics is the one that we all know, but there were 6 games mentioned in all. 4 of them are quite major, like the Olympics would have been known all over the Greek world, but one of them, Na, would only really been of interest in northwest Greece, suggesting a connection with that region. And then just recently, another one, the Helleia Games, were held on Rhodes and would only really been interest there. So it's starting to help scholars kind of build a picture of where was this thing made, why was it made, and the sort of the main theory so far is that it was probably made on Rhodes. So we know that the ship sailed in the first century BC and that it stopped off at Rhodes, and we know that at that time there was a philosopher called Posidonius who was working on Rhodes. Now Cicero also wrote about a similar astronomical device made by Posidonius. So there was already a kind of idea that perhaps Posidonius is responsible in some way for this mechanism, and now seeing these Rhodes games on that dial strengthens that. And possibly it was being made for perhaps a rich client in northwest Greece and was being shipped there. So, you know, we don't know for sure, but that's one of the theories that's happening.
So it may be a one-off. It may have been a bespoke single item or...
Yeah, I think this would have been a luxury, very expensive device, hundreds of man hours going into this. I'm sure it wasn't the only one, but it would have been a very special object, yes.
Brendan, it sounds as if you had to leave just as things started getting really exciting, just as you started finding the spear and I think part of a large anchor as well, which I think may tell you something about what kind of vessel this was. Are you going to get back? You must be itching to.
Yes. In fact, this morning, my colleagues in Athens and I have been trading emails planning the next expedition. There'll be a new Minister of Culture and several other positions below him. So we're waiting for that to sort itself out. But we expect to have our permits issued within a month or so. And we'll be back in the water, we hope, with more mapping in June. And then excavation seasons to follow immediately afterwards.
So you were saying you want to put a metal detectors on an ROV, I believe you were saying, and to try and understand a bit more about what seems to be a larger wreck site than you were originally anticipating for the one vessel at least. Is that right?
That's right. When we first got on the site in 2012, we had circumnavigated the entire island with our technical diving equipment, and we had found a concentration of artifacts about 250 meters south of where the statues and the mechanism came up in 1900. We thought at the time that it was a second shipwreck from the same time period carrying the same kinds of ceramics as the Antikythera wreck itself. So one of the big questions we had going into the 2014 season was, is this in fact two separate distinct wrecks? Or is it one ship that wrecked and then smeared itself all along that underwater slope? What we found is that there are artifacts between those two concentrations over that entire 250-meter-long stretch. And at the very southern extremity, we started finding things that were particularly interesting. For instance, a collection of anchors, lead anchors, that are the largest that any of us have ever seen. This is interesting because it's possible that what we're looking at is not a medium-sized ship from the early Roman period, but instead one of the grain carriers, one of the massive, mighty ships that was really one of the engines that allowed Rome to develop a population of over 1 million inhabitants. So grain coming in from Alexandria, from the Black Sea. If that's the case, then it would be very, very exciting for maritime archaeology and for ancient history.
What's on your wish list to find when you go back? I mean, you talked about finding this spear. Do you think that means there may be actual statues still down there, or do you think they would have been sort of perhaps looted over the years or were brought up initially in the first investigations?
The wish list is a very, very good question. One of the joys for me over the last few years of this project have been traveling around to New York, to London, and other places and querying the experts on the mechanism and asking them, okay, if the mechanism's on this ship, what else could be down there? It's wonderful to watch people begin to sort of dream about what could be on this wreck. It's possible that this was a traveling cabinet of curiosities. So all of these wonderful things that had been invented and manufactured in the ancient world sort of concentrated on this one ship. So wouldn't it be wonderful to find more pieces of the mechanism? That would be great. The bronze statues that must be down there, that would be fantastic too. But who knows? The mind boggles thinking about what else could be there. Certainly things that haven't been seen in 2,000 years.
Seraphine, do you get any hints from the ancient texts of what sort of other devices may or other technologies were being at least thought about at those kinds of times?
Oh, yes, because we have quite a lot of texts that describe machines. Some do look as if they couldn't have been built, but some look kind of more realistic, and also they're matched by description in literary texts. So I got like my own wish list of things that I would like someone to find. For instance, one of Hero of Alexandria's automata, kind of self-moving puppets, almost robots. He has a whole book to describe them. And we know that they existed because there are mentions of them in other texts. But we never really found one, especially one complete with mechanism. That would be my number one. But my list goes on, like even a weightlifting machine, like a full one, proper one, that would be nice.
So how did that work?
Well, it had a system, the one that Hero describes, there's one that he describes that there's a system of cogwheels. So if anything, it's the thing that reminds me most of the system of cogwheels we got in the Antikythera mechanism. One like that, but there were also ones that just had systems of pulleys, for instance. We found pulleys and so on, but something on a really large scale, nicely preserved, would be nice.
And tell me about Hero's puppet. I don't know much about that.
So Hiro describes what he calls theaters of automata. So they would be like little stages with mythological scenes or like animal scenes. Like you'd have, for instance, a mythological scene with a little puppet made of each mythological character. And then you had a mechanism which needed to be hidden. Hiro is quite adamant in the text that it won't work unless you hide the mechanism completely, because it would spoil the surprise. And then with a combination of often ropes, weights that fall, and then there's another pulley and another thing moves, you would set the whole thing in motion. And he was also very keen on producing the right sounds. So for instance, he has one of these theaters of puppets, of robots, is birds singing in different tunes. And they're kind of neat. They've been disparaged because they weren't useful. But if we think of technology today, I mean, some of the technology that, like, you know, drives the economy is not, properly speaking, useful. So,
but it is a little bit frustrating, and maybe that's unfair, that these technologies were exquisite, but yet seem to have been produced almost as entertainment, or primarily for entertainment, whereas if they had actually harnessed that and used it in a very sort of functional, effective way for improving the society and all the rest of it, then where would we be today?
That's counterfactual history. Where would we be today? I don't know. But I think, like any technology, even today, the fact that the technology is possible doesn't mean that the technology is realized. And the fact that the technology is out there doesn't mean that there is an interest or a market or enough motivation to actually develop it or invest into it. And I don't think they were particularly interested in productivity, or at least not to the level that we are. So they were interested in producing a surplus, but what they had available to them, and there was progress in some technologies, so it's not like technology didn't progress at all, it did. That, I think, satisfied their needs for the times they were living in. The Industrial Revolution happened not just because there was steam power. Steam power had been there all along. There was a number of factors that came together, and then it just happened. And those factors weren't there in the ancient world.
It's one of the issues that they actually had manpower in the form of slaves to do work, that they didn't need machines.
That's actually been greatly overstated. I'm going out on a limb here and saying obviously they had slaves, but they also had a lot of free labor. Some economies were more dependent on slaves than others, so there were a lot of slaves in some provinces of the empire, in the Roman Empire, but not so much in others. You have to think that free labor was, for some aspects, convenient, because you don't have to accommodate, to give them accommodation and to feed them all the time. And when the harvest season is finished, you can send them back home. So that makes sense as well, in economic terms.
Joe, didn't Arthur C. Clarke have something to say about this Antikythera mechanism, and if the Greeks had carried on building with that, they may have got somewhere else?
Yeah, he did. He said if only they'd been able to build on the technology, perhaps the Industrial Revolution would have happened more than a millennium ago, and by now we would have reached the nearest stars, because I think when he said it, we were just getting to the moon. I don't think most historians would really take that seriously, but that was certainly his view, and it's a, you know, it's a kind of inspiring thing to think about.
Let's come back to you, Brendan. I'm keen to, before we finish, just to understand how you pull a team together and how you fund an operation like this, because artists will be funding their work through applying to government bodies or hooking up with industry. You have to work on a different model. How does that happen, and what are the kind of compromises that brings your way?
That's how I spend most of my time, actually. I'm always looking for new sponsors and new funding sources. When I started out in the field, when I was first hired at Woods Hole Oceanographic, my department chair at the time said, "You're trying to do something new here. Deep water archaeology, maritime archaeology in the way that you envision it has never really been done. It's a new academic field. So the first thing you should do is establish your credentials by winning grants from the standard bodies, the National Science Foundation, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Foundation. If you can do that, then you'll be recognized as a legitimate scientist." So I did that and had great success winning grants from those bodies. But when the economic crisis hit and those budgets constricted quite a lot, it became very hit or miss to get any funding at all from the federal sources. And from the get-go, there wasn't a whole lot of money available for underwater archaeology, some hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And very quickly, we were absorbing, our program was absorbing a third of the available federal monies. So that was unsustainable, clearly. But then I realized that we've got a great thing going here with archaeology generally, with shipwreck archaeology particularly, and with a very high-tech approach to shipwreck archaeology even more specifically. We ought to be the best-funded scientists in the world because the popular interest is so great. Also, what happened in those first years at Woods Hole was a succession of tech billionaires came through the Deep Submergence Laboratory where I sit. And they all had pet projects, things that they were interested in exploring. And I realized that these people who had as much money as one could possibly ever want, they had made their fortunes in Silicon Valley. But now what they wanted to do with their time and their money was what my job was. So that opened up my eyes, and it opened up new doors to these new sources of funding. So a lot of our funding now comes from private individuals, private benefactors, largely in the United States of America, but also more recently in Greece. This is how we start to put together the funding for these complex operations. And our budgets are typically much higher than other archaeologists by an order of magnitude. But that's what comes with the territory, using robotic systems and getting into deep water. It's absolutely necessary.
Does that bring up fresh tensions, though? I mean, I think a lot of scientists who'll get grants will think they can just get on with their research sort of without any kind of outside interference. But if you're taking money from, say, a group of billionaires or what have you, then I'm wondering if they want to have more involvement in the work than a typical scientist might enjoy.
Every funding source comes with its own strictures. For instance, right now in the United States, if you want to apply for federal monies, you ought to be applying for polar research or climate change research. That's where the money is, largely. So, you know, you have to think that there's always some string attached. There's always some horses that are being bet on by the funding sources. And in my case, we've got a great coterie of sponsors, and they generally support what we do without trying to direct it in any way. Now, that said, one of my longest-standing benefactors in the U.S. said to me some years ago, you know, it would be really great if on your project you could find an ancient statue. I'd be so proud to visit the National Archaeological Museum in Athens and see on display a statue that our money helped save from the depths. So that's always been in the back of my mind. It's lovely that Antikythera may produce for that sponsor and, well, for the rest of the world to enjoy as well.
Joe here was along for the expedition you did late last year and wrote up a big piece about it in Smithsonian Magazine this month. And I noticed in there she mentioned that you actually turned down money from National Geographic to come along board on this particular expedition. I mean, maybe I don't know if you want to speak about the specifics of that decision, but it suggested to me that clearly there were times when scientists doing this work may not want certain partners involved because there may be issues that come up.
That's true. And National Geographic had offered some generous funding, but it came with the strings attached that they would have the right to portray the science in any way that they saw fit without any input from me. And that's a problem because in Greece, of course, there are heightened political sensitivities to anything relating to their ancient culture. And it seemed to me that the only way, the safest way to make sure we could continue working in Greece is to be certain that the project was portrayed in the right light. So we backed away from the offer of support from National Geographic and went another route.
When you go back this year, and hopefully you may get a chance to bring some other stuff up from the wreck, how are you going to look after that stuff to make sure it is properly conserved?
Yeah, this is absolutely the essential question. It's unethical to recover anything from an archaeological site unless you can be absolutely guaranteed that the material will be properly conserved, properly curated, and obviously properly exhibited so that the public can share in the wonder. From the moment we stepped foot back on shore after recovering the spear, we were having conversations to the highest levels of the Greek government, including the Prime Minister and certainly the Minister of Culture, about how we would proceed in the future. Now, the great news is that the Greek government has responded beautifully. They've established a new scientific laboratory around the corner from the offices of the Effort of Underwater Antiquities in Athens to handle specifically the artifacts from Antikythera. We're in discussions with the directors of the National Archaeological Museum and the National Maritime Museum to figure out how we'll exhibit these artifacts, assuming that we find what we expect. So I'm really quite confident that anything we bring up will be properly handled.
When are you going to get back in the water? You've whetted our appetite now. When are you going to be back in?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on many, many things, including the schedules of our team, because everyone's coming from around the world and everyone has other projects that they're involved with. And, of course, the funding. The funding has come in. We have plenty pledged, but we're still a little bit short on funding for some areas, some line items in our budget. So I'm traveling around now, visiting sponsors and trying to get that money in hand. We expect that as soon as the map is produced, we hope by mid-June, that any time after that, we can get in the water and start to excavate. Probably it will be toward the end of the summer, late August and then into September for 3 or 4 weeks. And if we get good weather, and we'll make more offerings to Poseidon and hope that that helps, we ought to be able to generate some very exciting results.
Brendan, we're going to watch this closely. And if you do get back in the water, we'll know about it and we'll be asking you back on to take us through what you found this time around.
My pleasure. I'd love that.
Let's take a look at some of the other stories making the science news. I'm joined by Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of Observer Tech Monthly, and by The Guardian's new science correspondent, Hannah Devlin. Hannah, let's come to you first. People can't have missed the story about mitochondrial transfer in the UK last week. What was that debate like in Parliament? How did that all go?
Yeah, so this was a story that's been rolling on and on for the last 5 or 6 years. It finally came to the House of Commons last week for a debate, just debating a very specific amendment that would allow mitochondrial donation in IVF. And the point of this procedure is to eradicate potentially certain very rare and very serious genetic illnesses. So there's been a lot of talk on either side. You know, obviously the stakes are high. This could have a huge impact on the lives of patients who are carriers of these genetic illnesses. But on the other hand, there's been talk of it being a slippery slope to designer babies, the idea that it's an untested technique, that there'll always be a leap of faith when you're trying something new, and whether we're really far enough along in the research to make that jump in the legislation. And overall, I thought the quality of the debate was quite high, and there were a lot of MPs who'd really got to grips with the science, and this is quite detailed genetic science.
I wasn't expecting that, because the number of sort of people in our parliament with scientific backgrounds is minimal, and this is pretty detailed science. I was surprised that the debate, as you say, was pretty good high quality.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps a case of, as well, of the scientists having been very proactive and from an early stage having really gone out and explained exactly what we're talking about here, that it's not actually going to be genetically altering any other characteristics of the babies other than this one very small part of the genome.
How their cells make energy, essentially.
To do with energy generation, yeah. So I thought overall it was quite impressive, the number of MPs that first turned up and second had got a good grasp of it. But I think in the end the anti-argument was fairly weak, because most of the MPs against it were making this claim that it had been rushed through and that the vote was premature, essentially, which I think is the one thing that you can say isn't the case, because this was first proposed in legislation in 2008. It's an amendment to that existing legislation. Mm. And there's been absolutely exhaustive consultations and reviews and, you know, scientific safety reports commissioned by the fertility regulator. So I think in the end it felt quite a weak argument, and also quite an extreme position to take, to say that this very narrow definition of genetic changes that you'll be making, we shouldn't allow.
Right. Let's be clear what this does and doesn't mean, this vote. It doesn't mean that anyone in the UK now can go out and try and do mitochondrial transfer if they have the kit. What happens next? What are the processes before we start seeing families going for this procedure?
So assuming, I mean, first we have to assume as well that this is passed in the Lords, which is, I think, going to be debated in the Lords later this month. Mm. But assuming that vote goes through as well, there'll be a 6-month interim period before any clinics can even apply for a licence from the fertility regulator, the HFEA, to be allowed to practice this technique. And even then, the regulator has to carry out an assessment of whether basic, you know, safety and so on is met.
And expertise.
Yes.
It's going to be going back to the Louise Brown days of sort of the first IVF baby. There'll be a whole media circus around whether this poor child ends up okay, and they'll be following them through to their 20s. So it's going to be an interesting one for the media to see how the media cope with this and how the families and the doctors cope with this as well, I think, because there'll obviously be huge, huge interest in it. Nicola, you wanted to talk about a piece in Tech Monthly.
That's right. So Tech Monthly came out in yesterday's Observer, but there's content going up all week online. And we have lots of great stuff this month. We've got a great piece by the Observer's Robert McCrum on brain attacks. So this is talking about the stroke that he suffered 20 years ago. And he talks to us about what we know and the large number of things and questions that we still are exploring, and how technology and robots are actually helping people on the road to recovery. Also on the theme of robots, looking at whether they're going to be taking your jobs, or indeed ours. And there's also interviews with the man who coined the phrase the Internet of Things and the world's best gamer, Sasha Scarlett-Hostin. But there's also a great piece by our science editor, Robin McKee, on NASA's new twin study, which is quite exciting. It should be launching at the end of March. And basically what they're doing is they've got a pair of astronauts who happen to be twins. So this is Scott and Mark Kelly.
Sickening overachievers.
Absolutely. And they're sending Scott off on a one-year mission to the International Space Station, while his twin brother Mark, who's now a retired astronaut, is staying on Earth. And basically what they're doing is they're monitoring a whole host of parameters. So they're looking, they're going to take samples of blood, of urine, of poo as well, and looking at lots of different biomarkers and lots of different aspects of their physiology. So, for example, they're looking at the bacteria in the guts of both Scott and Mark, and they're going to be comparing what happens to Scott's microbiota when he's in space compared to Mark's when he's on Earth. Also, experiments that are going to be looking at, for example, how fluid around your body moves when you're in space. So it sort of flows a bit differently than when you're on Earth. And they're going to be looking at lots of proteins and other biomarkers involved in these sort of physiological changes that were observed when people go into space. Of course, there are sort of downsides with this whole idea. This is a sample size of, you know, one pair of twins. So This is not exactly the best study in the world ever. Obviously, Mark is not sitting in a little glass box in a lab somewhere. He's going to be living life on Earth. So he's not maybe the perfect control. And also, Mark has been in space as well as Scott in the past. So if space does have some influence on your DNA or on your microbiota, if that changes a permanent influence, then that won't necessarily show up because Mark's also been exposed to space flight as well. But nevertheless, it's still an interesting study, and you can read all about it in Tech Monthly.
And when are we going to get the results from that? I mean, he's up there for a year. Does that mean we've got a year plus sort of writing up results time,
yeah,
or will these results being fed back and processed all the time,
yeah,
throughout that year?
So what's happening is that they're going to be blood samples sent down by Scott throughout the year. And so they'll be analysed. They're sort of being rushed to lab sort of within 24 hours.
So they're coming down on Soyuz.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that has to be quite carefully timed. I mean, this is all sort of a very tight timetable of when they can take the samples and how they can be shipped around. And then also after he returns to Earth, there will also be ongoing studies between the two. So this is actually quite a big commitment. They'll be sort of being sampled. So it could yield some interesting sort of hints as to what space can do to you.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. I mean, these guys are used to having all sorts of things tested on them, so I'm sure it won't be too much of a hardship for them. That's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Brendan Foley, Joe Marchant and Serafina Cuomo, and to Nicola Davis and Hannah Devlin. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.